I love the story that Billy Graham tells of how he was coming back one time on a plane to North Carolina, and he happened to be seated behind a man who got very raucous. He got very loud and boisterous because he'd had too much to drink. And the flight attendants really didn't know what to do with the guy until finally one of them came and they informed him, said, "Do you realize that Dr. Billy Graham is sitting right behind you?" And the man immediately, in his intoxicated state, turned around and said, "Oh, Dr. Graham, I went to one of your crusades one night, and I'll never forget it. It changed my whole life." Now, that's not the kind of change that we're talking about here in Genesis chapter 32. This was a revolutionary experience for Jacob. This was when finally God broke through all of the facade, all of the veneer around Jacob's life, all of the deceit, all of the conniving, the striving, the dreaming, the scheming, all of these things which were so much a part of Jacob's life as he was just living it on his own, until finally this memorable experience in his life once and for all, forever, changed Jacob into the man that God wanted him to be. But it was a long struggle. And it all comes to this climax at this time in Jacob's life, when 20 years after the experience that we dealt with last week in chapter 27, where he steals the blessing from his brother Esau by deceiving him many times over, defrauding his brother. And now he spends 20 years in a very difficult land under very difficult circumstances with his uncle Laban. And then God says, "All right, Jacob, time to go back and face the music." Look in chapter 31, verse 3. Here's God's command. And I call to your attention two parts to this command. 31, verse 3. "Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, to your family." That's the command. And then secondly, "I will be with you." There's the promise. And whenever God commands us to do something, He always promises He's going to go with us. I thought of that this morning as we were commissioning all of these young people and adults who are going to be going out on short summer and summertime ministries and missions around the world. And it's a great thing. When God commands us and He lays it upon our heart to do something, then He also gives us the promise that He will be with us. Jesus said, "Go out and make disciples of all the nations. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." It's a wonderful thing to recognize that when God commands us, He's going to go with us. But somehow or another, though Jacob realized God had commanded that he was to go, he forgot the promise that "I will go with you." So here in the opening verses of chapter 32, we have the problem that is established, and the problem is this. God says, "Jacob, go." Jacob begins to go with this large entourage of family members, wives, children, all of the extended family, as well as his possessions, his servants, all of his cattle, his herds of sheep, flocks of goats, all of these things. God had greatly blessed him while he was in the land, and now he's to go back to his brother Esau. But notice when we get down in chapter 32, verses 3 through 5, he sends out some messengers to find out what is the state of Esau. What kind of a frame of mind is he in? You see, the problem is Jacob was fearing for his life. And in verse 5, he says, "I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male, female servants I've sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight." The messengers went out, they returned in verse 5, verse 6, saying, "Jacob, we came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you." And notice how they throw this in, 400 men are with him. Problem. 400 men. Can you imagine the terror that went through Jacob's veins when he gets this word? Yet God had said, "Jacob, go back. Go back and I will be with you." One of the principles that we learn here in all of this is that you may leave a lot of unfinished business in your life. And I've been in the ministry long enough to know that people die with unfinished business. You may never graduate from college. You may never allow God to be all that He wants to be in your marriage. You might leave an unfinished business, literally your place of work, your resident, your profession, all of it. You might even leave your house unfinished. And that's not a big concern with God. But one thing that does concern God is when we have offended another human being, He does not want that business to be unfinished. You might be involved in a marriage that seems to be going nowhere. You're thinking about just getting out of that marriage, just walking away from it, going on, establishing another. It's just going to be so simple just to do it. And you can just pick up your life and you can go on. No, you can't. God doesn't allow it to be that simple. You seek to resolve, to restore that broken marriage. God doesn't allow you to just walk away from it, because the moment you do, you're going to take all of those problems into your next marriage, and you're going to find that you never dealt with it back here, so now you got to deal with it here. So why not deal with it back here where you have less wreckage, less destruction? God is concerned about our relationships with other people who are created in His image. Genesis gives us this marvelous sense of the dignity of humanity. That we have significance. That person you've offended has significance. You've defrauded someone, you've wronged someone, you've deceived someone in your past, and you just think you can walk away from it. No, you can't. God says, you're never going to experience the victory and the freedom that I want you to have. You're never going to be the person that I intended for you to be until you go back and face the music. By the way, do you know where that term "face the music" comes from? It's an interesting phrase we often use. The Imperial Orchestra in Japan that always played for the emperor. One time in the past had a man of great influence and wealth in Japan who always had as his ambition to play in that orchestra. The problem was he didn't know one musical instrument from the other. He decided he would play the flute, and so he kind of bought his way into the Imperial Orchestra. The conductor didn't have him audition. He just said, come, you can sit in the second chair. You can fake playing the flute. Just don't make a noise with it. That's all I ask you. Just don't make a noise with it. So the guy did that for 2 years, even got to play an audience before the emperor. But then something happened. They changed conductors. And the conductor decided that every member of that orchestra had to do a personal audition. It came the man's turn. He literally got sick in his stomach. He couldn't do it. They sent him to the doctor to get doctor's clearance. Is this guy healthy or isn't he? Doctor said, there's nothing wrong with the man. But he never went to the conductor. Never played the flute because he couldn't stand to face the music. And Jacob simply didn't want to face the music, and maybe you don't. Don't allow unresolved conflicts in your past to continue. You cannot walk away from them. It's not that simple. You say, well, I've done everything I can do to try to resolve those conflicts in my past. And if you have, and you've tried to do it God's way, the biblical way, with the right attitude, then the burden of the responsibility is placed on the other person's shoulders. But until you've done everything that you can to resolve that and restore it, whether it's with your parents, with your children, with a sibling, until you've done everything that you know is humanly possible from a biblical perspective to do, then you have no freedom to walk away from an unresolved relationship. God clearly establishes that here in this passage. And Jacob, the old deceiver, the conniver, is now reaping what he has sown. We do reap what we sow. And Jacob had deceived his brother. So what happens? He ends up in his uncle Laban's household. And he served 7 years for Rachel, but on the wedding night, He is deceived by his uncle Laban, who slips Leah in place of Rachel. And Jacob has to serve another 7 years for Rachel. And then he ends up serving another 6 years, a total of 20 years, for all of these possessions, all of the flocks and the herds and all of these things that God wanted to give him, but he wasn't going to give it to Jacob overnight. And during those next 6 years, a total of 20 years, Uncle Laban changed his wages 10 times on him, lest Jacob get the upper hand. I like what J. Vernon McGee says in his commentary about Jacob. He said he got his college degree at the College of Hard Knocks. Uncle Laban was the president and dean of the school. At graduation, this boy Jacob gave a pitiful valedictorian address. It took him 20 years to get his degree, and he certainly worked for it. Old Laban changed the requirements 10 times. Every 2 years, Jacob had a new contract with Uncle Laban. It was always to Jacob's disadvantage. This was the experience of this man. So finally, God says, all right, it's time. Time to go home. And he does. So Jacob, because of the problem, in verse 7, he's greatly afraid, he's distressed. That's saying it mildly. What does he do? He makes a plan. He divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to the one company, attacks it with his 400 men, then the other company which is left will escape. He says, here's my plan. In his human wisdom, the best thing he could come up with is, I'll divide all of my family and my possessions into two different groupings, so that if he attacks and he destroys one, at least I will have the other. Tried to protect himself. But somehow or another, he knew that plan wasn't going to work. He's becoming a desperate man, like his brother Esau, who was desperate after he had been so terribly deceived. Notice in verse 9, then he turns to praying, which is something we all should do in time of need. And I'm just going to summarize this prayer for sake of time this morning. But notice there are two parts of it. First of all, Jacob reminds God of what God had said. He said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country, to your family, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I've crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I become two companies. He's simply reminding God of what God had promised. He said, Jacob, you go, and I will be with you. And Jacob says, Lord, that's what you told me, and now here I am, and I don't know what to do. And then he says, as he prays for deliverance, verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. This was a marvelous prayer. And maybe you've been praying a prayer like that. Lord, this is what you promised in this situation with all of these conflicts in my past and all of these broken relationships. And God, this is what your word says, so I know what you desire for my life. And so, Father, I'm just helpless. I'm helpless in this situation to know what to do. But you deliver. And so Jacob gets up off of his knees. He still has too much of Jacob in him. This is so typical of all of us. Shows you how authentic the Bible is. It addresses and exposes our human nature like no other book could possibly do. Jacob, the minute he gets up off of his knees, starts to plan. It's almost like he forgot his prayer. Verse 13, he lodged there, he came that night, took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 male camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 foals, and then he delivered them to the hand of his servants. If I've counted this right, 550 animals. Jacob now is going to send to Esau to appease him as a gift. It shows us something about how God had blessed Jacob while in the land with his uncle Laban. That he had this much to give, and it didn't hurt him a bit in giving it up. And so as I think of this, I think Jacob knew how God had blessed him. He could see that God's hand was obviously upon his life. Why is it then that Jacob was so hesitant about going back, knowing that God says, Jacob, I'll be with you when you go back and are confronted by your brother Esau? I've got that in my hands too. So he gets up, starts to plan. You know, I don't know how you do. I know how I do. You pray. You say, Lord, I got a problem with my wife. I got a problem with my husband. Connie and I don't have any problems, by the way, so don't read anything into that. We have normal problems, yes, but we're not stressed out in our marriage right now. We're doing well. Not everybody is, but we're doing well, and we understand it. But you know, you say, Lord, this problem is too big for me. I can't handle this. So you go to the Lord in prayer, and you give it to him. But the minute that you get up off your knees, you go and you try to resolve it. You come up with a plan. Instead of letting God work it out, you come up with a plan that many times is simply a futility exercise in the flesh. And you see your daughter or you see your son that's not reacting the way you want to, and you take it to the Lord in prayer, and then you come back, and the minute you see your son or your daughter act up again, you instead of talking to God about them, you immediately jump on your daughter or your son or that loved one, and you're trying to work it out in your own fleshiness. Someone has rightly said we need to spend more time talking to God about our children, our problems, and less time talking to our children about God. That's good advice. He's able to handle it. He already knew how he was going to change Esau's mind and heart. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, like channels, rivers of water. He can move it where he wants to. He can change the heart of that person whom you have so deeply offended, if you're willing to take that step and go back and recognize this is God's will for your life. That brings us to this final point, which is really the heart of this whole passage, and that is phase four, Jacob's prevail. He goes from the problem to the prayer to the plan and finally to the prevail here. He arose that night, in verse 22, took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, crossed over the ford of Jabbok, took them, sent them over the brook, and sent them over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. And a man, this is not just a man, not just any man, this was not an ordinary wrestling match. In fact, the word for wrestle here in verse 25, verse 24, in our Hebrew Bibles, it's only used once, and that's here. And it comes from the same word as the word dust. So the picture that we have of Jacob at this moment is God had isolated Jacob because he's saying, enough is enough, Jacob. I've had enough of your planning, enough of your conniving, your scheming, your deceitfulness. And he literally had Jacob down in the dust. I mean, this was a wrestling match when God had Jacob as low as he could have him, down in the dust. And all night long he wrestles with Jacob. Hosea chapter 12 and verse 4 gives us a further commentary on this, by the way. It says, yes, he, Jacob, struggled with the angel. And I believe this angel was the pre-incarnate Christ. You see, Christ appeared many times in the Old Testament in what we call pre-incarnate forms. That is, incarnation. That's when he came literally as a physical man, the God-man 2,000 years ago. But prior to that, Christ often appeared in a pre-incarnate form. I think that's what we have here. It was Christ who was wrestling with Jacob. There's no imaginary encounter. Jacob at first didn't know who it was because God had disguised himself in the form of a man. Had Jacob known it was really God, he'd have probably given up much earlier. But the feeling that I get from this passage is literally Jacob was exhausted. But notice what it says. When God, verse 25, and I'm translating this the way it would read in our understanding, when God saw that he did not prevail against him. Isn't that a paradox, a contradiction? Jacob would not give up. God could not prevail against him. Well, of course he could have. But he didn't at this moment for a very good reason. He didn't because Jacob could only win by losing. And there's a principle here that when we lose with God, that's when we really prevail with God. When we allow God to win, we lose is when we win. You heard that in Jane's testimony this morning. That when we lose is when we win with God. Luke chapter 14 and verse 11. He who exalts himself is going to be humbled. He's going to be abased. But he who humbles himself will be exalted. So that when we lose to God is when we win with God. And that's why the narrator tells us that Jacob prevailed against God. Why? Because he lost to God. Let me ask you a question. Have you lost to God yet? I really am convinced after all of these years that it's a dramatic moment in the life of a person that you're going to be able to look back and you're going to be able to say, that was the dark night of my soul when I lost, but when I won. When I lost to God, but when I prevailed with God. And then he asked him, he says to Jacob, God says to Jacob, Jacob, what is your name? Obviously God knew who Jacob was, but he wanted Jacob to know who Jacob was. So Jacob had to give his name one more time. Notice in verse 27 and 28. What is your name? He said, Jacob. What was he saying? God is saying to Jacob, Jacob, here's who you really are. You're a supplanter. You're a heel catcher. You're a schemer. You're a deceitful man. You have tripped up others. And now the one who had tripped up others was being tripped up by the eternal God. And he wanted Jacob to remember this experience. So he dislocated his hip. It's a great, great way to remember something, isn't it? Dislocated joint. Put his hip out of joint. I was watching the NBA, some of the games recently, when one of the big players, I don't remember which team it was before, but some of you guys were probably watching that game, this great big 6'10" man, 250, 260 pounds, dislocated his shoulder, went down on the floor writhing in pain. Here was a man, this bulk, this hulk of humanity that was totally incapacitated by his shoulder being out of joint. Doctors would verify that this hip joint and this muscle that goes down this past this hip socket is the strongest muscle in the human body. God's the one who made us, and God knew that if he afflicted Jacob in that part of his body where he was the strongest, that it would indeed be an experience that Jacob would never forget. So that's what he does. From that day onward, Jacob walked like this the rest of his life. Every time he went down, he would come up, and it was a reminder to him that God was the one on whom he was dependent. And the great lesson that comes out of this passage is that sometimes God has to isolate us before he can get our attention. We're so busy making plans, so busy going through life deceiving, covering up our deceitful schemes, conniving, covering our tracks, leaving unfinished business back here, that finally God allows something disastrous to come into our lives to get our attention. And he literally isolates us. It may be in a hospital room. It may be It may be in a marriage where you've just lost absolutely everything around you. It might be your business has crumbled and you feel so helpless and so isolated and nobody else understands. God has you isolated. God has you right where He wants you. The beautiful thing about it is God changes His name from Jacob to Israel. Verse 28, you'll no longer be Jacob, but Israel, meaning you'll no longer be the heel catcher, the supplanter, the deceitful one who's going about living his own life in his own strength. But Jacob, you will now become the one who has prevailed with God. That God will be your fighter from this moment on. And Jacob, it will be me who will bring you into the land of Canaan. It will be me who will make your relationship with Esau what it ought to be. I will be the one who will restore it. And Jacob, remember this later on, when your people want to go into the land of Canaan, that it will not be the people, it will not be by might nor by power, but by my spirit, by my strength, that you'll be able to go into the land. So he gave him a permanent hip dislocation. And that's why when we get to the end, the narrator says in verse 32 that he touched the socket of Jacob's hip and the muscle that shrank, and because of that, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle of that part of any of the flesh of any animal. As a reminder to them, that was true up through the time that Moses wrote. They could not eat that portion of the muscle. I had a dark night like this in my soul back in the fall of 1970. I've shared it before, but it's so fitting. I knew I was dying, and I would have died. It was the night before I really thought I would die by the next day. An undiagnosed disease. None of the doctors in our area were able to diagnose it. Until finally, God led me, and it was by His grace, He led me to a doctor who was at George Washington University Med School at the time that Kennedy was president. And it was common knowledge that John F. Kennedy had Addison's disease. And this doctor looked at me, wrote down adrenal insufficiency, which is Addison's disease, put me in the hospital for 10 days. And that night, I struggled with God like I've never struggled with God. I said, God, I'm in my last year of seminary. Is this the way it's going to end? I've got a beautiful wife, two daughters that you've allowed me to bring into this world. I feel so hopeless, so helpless, so isolated. I'll never forget, as I wrestled with God, the peace that came into my life. And I discovered something in that moment that stuck with me through the years. That when we lose everything but God, we discover that God is all that we need. And that's what Jacob discovered. That God was all he needed from that moment on. Have you made that discovery with God yet? You can go through the darkest trials, the most difficult experiences. But when you have God, you have all you need. I want us to bow our heads in prayer. I know God is at work this morning in the lives of some of you. Maybe you've been going through a dark night in your own soul. so dark that you can't even share it with anybody. Maybe this has been helpful this morning. I hope it has. If you don't know Jesus Christ, you've yet to make that great discovery. He is everything the Bible says He is. And He will be with you when all others forsake you. As the psalmist said, when my father and my mother forsake me, the Lord, He'll take me up. He never will. You need Him most of all. He changed Jane's life, changed Liz's life, He changed Rod's life, changed Jim's life. He'll change your life. But it's time that you take that step. You need to come forward this morning. Let somebody help answer some of your questions. Father, I don't know how you want to use this, but I know you're at work. And I just simply give the results and how you choose to use it to you. Give people the courage to come if they need to come. And give them the courage to go if they need to go and restore some broken relationships. And let them sense your presence, that you will never leave them nor forsake them. Thank you for these moments. In Jesus' name, amen.